Up next on Coast to Coast AM, the real story of how the FBI does what it does. It's an incredible story, and our special guest Ronald Kessler has it next on Coast to Coast AM. Ronald Kessler is the New York Times best-selling author of 19 nonfiction books, including The Secrets of the FBI in the President's Secret Service and the CIA at War. A former Washington Post and Wall Street Journal investigative reporter, Kessler is now the chief Washington correspondent of Newsmax.com. Ronald, welcome to Coast. How are you?
Very good. Great to be with you.
How'd you like that music introduction for you?
That was beautiful.
I remember that great thing. There was so much pride with the FBI during that television show with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. I remember it as in my younger days. Are those days still around or are they gone?
Well, the FBI is still a brand name. I think people still respect the FBI, but there's a lot of misinformation about the FBI, a lot of misunderstanding. There were tremendous abuses under J. Edgar Hoover. He never focused on real threats. He confused political dissent with criminal conduct. And so the FBI has progressed a lot since then, but it still has tremendous secrets. And that's why I wrote this book, The Secrets of the FBI, because I was aware that FBI agents not only develop secrets in the course of their investigations, but pick up secrets in other ways too. You know, for example, in the book, I talk about the fact that just after Marilyn Monroe's death, a teletype came into headquarters from the head of the Los Angeles field office saying that he had lent his personal car to Bobby Kennedy, the attorney general, to go see Marilyn secretly just before her death, and that he had been doing that on a regular basis. So, of course, that suggests not only an affair, but possibly Bobby had broken up with her, and that's why she committed suicide. Secrets like that are riveting and have to do with a lot of history.
With the kind of media we have today, if we had today's media back then, would they have uncovered more stories?
Oh, yeah, no question. I think a lot of these abuses would have come out. But it was, as you say, a different era. The press never would have taken on the FBI. Jack Anderson, just before Hoover's death, did start to go into some of the problems. And also, by the way, went through Hoover's garbage and reported what he was, what kind of shampoo he used and what kind of shaving cream he used. But Hoover was really more powerful than presidents because he was director for almost 50 years.
Well, he was smart enough to get all the skinny on everybody, right?
That is the secret to his longevity, that he had all these files on everybody from Frank Sinatra to JFK, members of Congress, and he would use them. He would use them for blackmail, and that's how he kept his job.
Was he good for the FBI?
I think he was half good and half bad, half a menace and half a patriot, because he did establish this really great organization. It's known as the Premier Law Enforcement Agency back then. He was very advanced in areas like fingerprinting, keeping indices on file with information in the files, the FBI laboratory. He insisted that agents not engage in brutality, which was very common in police agencies at the time. He engaged in these. He made sure that agents told the truth in their reports. But at the same time, he engaged in these abuses, which were just monumental. So, I think half and half is the answer.
The FBI, strong organization, how necessary is it to our government for us to function, to us to do what we do?
Well, it's crucial, you know, whether you look at a kidnapping or whether you look at terrorism. And the reason we haven't been attacked since 9/11, haven't had a successful attack, is the FBI, along with the CIA, which gives the FBI tips. Every few months, you see arrests by the FBI of terrorists. That's the bottom line. That shows that they're doing their job. So, all the way through history, whether it was World War II, whether it was the period when they had these extremists doing bombings in New York, you had the FBI on the job, doing a pretty good job.
What got you to write about the FBI, Ronald?
I've always liked the challenge and the fact that the FBI is such a secretive agency was something that attracted me, as well as the fact that it's so important and, of course, that it's so powerful and can go off course so easily. It's a complex agency. There are so many different nuances to the laws that it enforces. So I just like a challenge. I don't like a simple task at all.
Why did Hoover hate so many people? I mean, he loved the mob. He'd go horse racing with them and everything else. But he hated the Kennedys. He hated Martin Luther King. He hated almost everybody.
He had this morality, whether you agree with it or not, which was very judgmental. And so, unless someone was of a certain political stripe, he was suspicious, and that was one of his problems. Because, for example, going after spies, he would confuse, as I said, political dissent with real criminal conduct, and the result was not only that he abused American rights, but also that he didn't do a very good job of focusing on the real spies. And, I've interviewed the agents who did the work at the time, and they've described that, and the fact that Hoover would support Joe McCarthy, who was just a horror in American history, until later he finally did withdraw support. All those things were major, major problems.
Do you think he knows what happened to Kennedy, how the assassination took place?
Yeah, I think that, believe it or not, the Warren Commission report, which is based almost entirely on the FBI investigation, does lay out the correct facts. I know that's heresy to say, but when people actually look at that report, they're very impressed by the level of detail, the forensics, and of course, whenever there's an assassination, there are always these conspiracy theories, and sometimes they turn out to be true, but
sure,
most of the time they're not. Most of the time they're simple nuts who just want attention.
Well, in this particular case, he had a lot of info, and like as you say, he stayed in for a long time. He stayed in. He basically just died in office, didn't he?
He did. 1972 May, just before Watergate, his housekeeper and another person found him lying on the floor of his bedroom dead, and I talked to the medical examiner, Dr. Luke, who didn't do an autopsy but did say there was a history of heart problems and that ruled it a natural death.
How old was he when he died?
Good question. Let's see. I think he was
70s?
Maybe 72 or so. Near the end, he was getting more and more idiosyncratic, and he had all these quirks. He didn't want agents to drink coffee. That was almost a firing offense, either in the office or out of the office. And he would have people, and FBI agents, track down anybody who did drink coffee, and they would be sent to Butte, Montana. Just very strange. And of course, he insisted on white shirts, had to be dressed a certain way. You could never, even if you were searching for bodies in a field, you had to be dressed in a suit.
77, according to my producer.
Okay, thank you.
So there he was. So let's talk a little bit about the Marilyn Monroe case. What do we know so far?
She was always troubled, and she was found with a lot of pills. There was an autopsy that found that she had overdosed, and I do think that was a suicide.
Yet Kennedy was there. Both Kennedys were with her, weren't they?
There was some report by one of the hangers-on that maybe Bobby was there, but I like to stick with, you know, real on the record facts. And what I did was I was able to interview the children of the head of the Los Angeles field office at the time, and they confirmed on the record that Bobby would borrow their father's white Lincoln Continental periodically, a convertible. And once they found his sunglasses in the glove compartment that he left there by mistake, so there's no question that Bobby was probably having an affair with Marilyn.
Why would he use these cards? Just because he assumed nobody would know who he was?
Exactly. And you know, as the Attorney General, he was entitled to protection by the FBI, but the FBI would have used their regular cars, referred to as Bew cars, affectionately, rather than a personal car, which was used, of course, to conceal the relationship.
In your book, you talk about how the FBI agents would break into homes and offices to plant bugging devices, and I assume they did that illegally, right?
Well, in the old days, that's right, but now, of course, it's done with court authorization.
Orders, yeah.
Yeah. And that is, I think, the most fascinating thing in this book, Secrets of the FBI. It's the most secret technique that they have, as you can imagine. And the FBI actually gave it to me. The director, Bob Mueller, approved giving it to me. I still can't believe it. About 20% of the book is about that. A lot of funny stories, a lot of tense situations where agents almost were shot and killed because here they are breaking into mafia homes, terrorist homes, even embassies, offices, and they could legitimately be thought of as burglars and shot and killed.
Oh, sure.
And even though it is done with court authorization. And what they do is several weeks before the break-in, agents will, on this TACOPS team, it stands for Tactical Operations, which is just a big euphemism for breaking into homes and offices. They will watch the premises, and they'll see who goes in and who goes out. And then on the night of the break-in, they will watch the homes of these individuals to make sure they don't go back to the premises. And if they do, they will divert them. They'll have a police officer stop them and do a traffic stop, or they'll let the air out of their tires, or they will open a fire hydrant in the area so they can't go back to, so nobody can go back to the area. They also take a photo of any dog that might be on the premises. They show that to a veterinarian who's on contract before the break-in. He prescribes just the right amount of tranquilizer to shoot into the dog with a dart gun. And then at the end of the break-in, they wake up the dog with another shot because they don't want to have any sleepy dogs around that might create suspicion. They go in with all these high-tech tools. They have high-speed drills that are silent to drill holes in walls so they can put bugs in. They match the paint if they need to with a computer algorithm. They will bring their own dust in case they disturb any dust on a tabletop or a desk, and they replace it with their own dust. They go to elevator school to learn how to take control of elevators. So if they're going to put bugs in an office building suite, let's say, they'll go in during the day, they'll take control of one of the elevators, get on top of the elevator, and then in the middle of the night, they come out, they go in the suite, they put the bugs in, and then in the morning, they walk out from the elevator wearing business suits, and nobody's wiser. They will also, let's say they need to bug a home in the middle of the night, they will take a photo sometimes of the front of the house. They'll blow that up into a huge tarp that they drape over the front of the house, and then they will go and work behind that tarp in the middle of the night to defeat the alarms and defeat the locks so that bystanders can't see them. They also may bring their own little artificial bush And two agents will hold this bush and walk slowly towards the front of the house
And hide behind it?
and hide behind it. And that will conceal them
A
as they're
walking
proceeding.
bush, huh?
Yeah. And one of the typical stories is they had to break into a mafia hangout in Philadelphia. It was an electronics store, but it was really a mafia front. And they couldn't go in the back door because it could be booby trapped. So they had to go in the front. But the front over was across the street from an all night bar. So how do they get in without being seen? Well, they board a city bus. The agents got on the bus. They drove in front of the premises. They got out. They put the hood up so to make it look as if it had broken down. They defeated the locks and the alarm systems. And, of course, they have these really high-tech methods for doing that. The bus went around the corner while they were putting the bugs in. It came back to pick them up, but it went by a bus stop. And there were two patrons from the bar at the bus stop, and they were infuriated that the bus didn't stop to pick them up. So they ran for the bus, and they got in front of the premises, and the agents were all from different offices and from the TAC ops teams, and they didn't realize that these guys don't belong with them. And so they thought everything was fine, but then some of the agents started taking off their weapons and their walkie-talkies, and these two guys started ringing to get off. Ding, ding, let me off, let me off. They were scared. And then the agent who was driving said, "Hey, guys, stop bothering me. I just learned how to drive this bus." He thought, you know, they were just trying to harass him. And finally, another agent got up, and he had a shotgun over his shoulder. And then they really started ringing to get off. Ding, 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 let me off, let me off. Finally, the agent who was driving let them off. They went running down the street, and nobody heard from them again.
Let's talk a little bit about the strange case of Vince Foster. He was a deputy White House counsel, committed suicide in 1993. Some say, as others think, perhaps not. What did you uncover?
I found that he did commit suicide. A lot of these conspiracy theories were unfounded, but at the same time, what never came out and is in this book, The Secrets of the FBI, that a week before his suicide, Hillary Clinton had a meeting with him in the White House with other top aides, and she totally reamed him out, humiliated him in front of all these other White House aides, called him a small town hick lawyer. You'll never make it in the big time.
And she was friends with him, right?
Yeah. In fact, he was her mentor back at the law firm in Arkansas. But this is typical Hillary, and simply because she disagreed with a legal interpretation that he had made. And after that, the FBI found that his behavior changed dramatically. He already was depressed, but he became much more withdrawn. He would break into tears easily. He didn't want to have any interaction with anybody. And a week later, he committed suicide. So the FBI concluded that meeting is what triggered his suicide. Now, maybe he would have committed suicide eventually anyway. We know it's an irrational act, but that's the story that never came out.
What couldn't he take? What pushed him over the edge?
It was the feeling that, gee, you know, he felt already like a failure. He took personally all this criticism, and then to have Hillary, who brought him to the White House, and to whom he had been a mentor, embarrass him in front of all these aides. I mean, we would all be pretty upset.
I wouldn't kill myself over that.
No, thank God. But
that's why many don't think he did that, that perhaps he was rubbed out.
I know. I pursued all those leads, and top medical examiners have debunked a lot of the claims about you know, where the bullets were and all that. And you know, there are always some little issues with these murders and assassinations.
Well, and he was on antidepressant drugs as well. Ronald, stay with us. We're going to come back and talk a little bit about this bizarre story with Osama bin Laden's fingerprints. We're talking about the secrets of the FBI, and we will be right back. Well, the Coast Store is open for you. Brand new material, shirts, cups, hats, and a whole bunch of other goodies. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com. Down at the bottom, you can click the store and off you go. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with Ronald Kessler as we talk more about the secrets of the FBI. Ronald, was it difficult for you to get these stories?
Well, I've been at this FBI business for a long time, and that helps. I already had some sources, some knowledge. I think a lot of them figured I already know a lot. And also, I try to tell an honest story, and they appreciate that. If the FBI screws up, I say that. For example, one of my previous books led to the dismissal of William Sessions as FBI director over his abuses. But when they do a good job, and you know they have been since 9/11 with terrorism, I say that, and they appreciate that. That's pretty unusual in journalism today.
Speaking of terrorism, you uncovered a very strange story about Osama bin Laden after he died. Tell us about it.
The FBI could not match his fingerprints, but the reason was they thought that they had his fingerprints from some previous documents, but it turned out that those documents really did not have his fingerprints. So they had no previous fingerprints to look at. They did match his DNA, and they also confirmed his identity with facial recognition software. So there's no question he was Osama, but his fingerprints were never matched.
So for all these years, they thought they had his fingerprints, and they never did.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, I mean, they marched him around. He was in the Los Angeles area at one time during his Mujahideen days to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's you know, this criminal investigation business is never perfect. There's always some problem, glitch, whatever, but then sometimes it works in the opposite direction, and that gives investigators some luck and some clues. That's the way, you know, a lot of our professions are. There are always little problems that occur.
Are they still using the latest technology, Ronald?
Yeah, they're very advanced. They were the ones that really pioneered DNA analysis way back. And today, you know, I was able to tour the FBI laboratory, and it's very impressive. They use the very latest techniques, and police agencies, of course, go to them as well, so that it's not just FBI cases. The same with criminal profiling. The FBI profilers will help out in local law enforcement cases as well.
Is the mob still around?
The mob is. It's amazing. You know, it just persists. And one of the weird things is, you know, they never seem to get rich. What are they doing? you know, all these mafia chieftains, they don't even take vacations. So it's still a threat, amazingly.
It is out there. Now, you also wrote a book called In the President's Secret Service. Weren't you the one who broke the prostitution Secret Service story?
That's right. I broke that in the Washington Post, and it was an aberration to have this kind of bad behavior. In fact, most of the time the agents are so overworked and overloaded, working overtime, that they don't have time for any life, let alone going to prostitutes. But I do see it as a symptom of the mismanagement that I exposed in this book, In the President's Secret Service. Involving winking and nodding about letting people into events without magnetometer screening, not keeping up to date with latest firearms, not insisting on regular firearms requalification or physical training tests. And then this lax attitude communicates to the agents. And I think these agents figured, hey, you know, management, you know, winks and nods, we'll do whatever we want. And I think that also is why you saw the Salahis go prancing into the White House state dinner.
Yeah.
Even though they were not on the guest list, those agents at the gate, uniformed officers, I think thought to themselves, gee, if we turn them away and it turns out that they were supposed to be guests, we could be in trouble. Our own management will not back us. And that goes back to, for example, one anecdote involving Mary Cheney, who was on who's being protected, Dick Cheney's daughter.
Right.
And she insisted that agents take her friends to restaurants. Well, they're not taxi drivers. They refused, as they should have been, as they should have. But because of that, she threw a fit and got her detail leader removed. So the management, instead of backing the guys doing his job, removed them. That sends a message, you know, to those officers at the gate, gee, let's just not make any waves.
Yeah, we're not going to back you, you know?
Exactly.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but at the same time, I was able to find out what presidents and vice presidents are really like behind the scenes from those Secret Service agents, because they're just like human surveillance cameras. They see everything that goes on behind the scenes, and in many cases, it's pretty shocking. Jimmy Carter, for example, would pretend to carry his own luggage, made a big show of that, but actually the luggage was empty, or he would give it to aides to carry as soon as the cameras were gone. He would sometimes come into the Oval Office at 5 in the morning and tell the press office to tell the press that he was in there working hard for the American people at 5 a.m., and then he'd fall asleep on the sofa. He was so nasty, he would tell agents he didn't want them to say hello to him in the morning on the way to the Oval Office. Apparently, it was just too much bother to say hello to another human being.
How bizarre.
Yeah. So you know, quite different from the good old boy peanut farmer image that he tried to project.
What did they think of Kennedy, John F. Kennedy?
They liked Kennedy, but of course they were totally aware of the...
indiscretions.
Philandering, yes. Yeah. One time, Jack was in the White House pool with these White House aides known as Fiddle and Faddle, and they were just wearing T-shirts, their nipples showing, nothing else on. And then Jackie, who was out, decided to come back unexpectedly, and her detail radioed the JFK detail that she was coming back. And so Jack came out of the pool, gave his Bloody Mary to one of the agents and said, try it, it's quite good. And that was that. He was very nonchalant about it.
And out they went.
Yeah. Never caught.
That's amazing. And I heard stories that Kennedy used to go to, like, Greenwich Village bars. He'd leave his New York hotel with or without the Secret Service even knowing where he went.
Well, that could be. I hadn't heard that, but you know, he was a big risk taker, no question, and he was constantly picking up girls. So it would be par for the course.
With all that's going on, one would think that this country is totally out of control, but it's not. I mean, by and large, it's still an organized group of organizations, whether it's the Secret Service or the FBI. They truly know what they're doing, don't they?
They do. You know, there are these missteps, but you know, especially since 9/11, there's been much more coordination. They don't have this so-called wall that prevented them from sharing information. The FBI has changed dramatically. Now, the first priority is getting leads to the next plot, as opposed to arresting people and prosecuting people and putting them in jail. And so it sounds like a nuance, but it makes a difference in terms of what their emphasis is. After the first World Trade Center bombing, for example, you know, the whole priority was get the bad guys, put them in jail, and that's what they did. They didn't spend much time trying to develop the leads on the next plot, and now it's quite different, and that's one of the reasons why you don't see any successful attacks. Another is that they've developed what they call tripwires with, for example, manufacturers of explosives, so that they will report any suspicious shipment. And that's how the FBI was able to arrest the guy who tried to blow up George W. Bush's home in Dallas. They got a lead from a tripwire. So again, very, very advanced thinking.
What do they think of this current administration?
It's a mixed bag. On the one hand, they say that, for example, Eric Holder's decision to try KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, in New York was irresponsible. They say that some of the other efforts to whitewash the war on terror and not even use the term is shocking. On the other hand, they believe that there's no problem with giving Miranda warnings, that they're able to develop cooperation regardless. For example, with the underwear bomber, they gave him the Miranda warning. He did shut up, but then they sent agents to develop cooperation with his family, and his family convinced him to talk, and finally he did. So ultimately he cooperated, even though he had been given the Miranda warning.
You know, with everything that's been going on this planet, Ronald, over the last several years, how would you compare our intelligence gathering with the Russians?
Oh, the Russians are very good, and they're very aggressive, just as aggressive as they were during the Cold War. But
they're still the same people, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right, same people, they're admired by the FBI and the CIA is doing a good job. So, they're probably on a par.
Where is the future for the FBI?
Interesting. Well, cybercrime is the wave of the future. They're working mm-hmm. on that. You know, everyone is just inundated with these efforts to penetrate both government and private computer operations. One FBI person said, the only really safe way to proceed is to not use the internet at all. That's how bad things are. So that's one area. But there are always these changes in emphasis based on the latest threats. During World War II, it was spies, espionage that was big. We had certainly during the financial crisis, we had a lot of white collar crime investigations, major frauds. We had the Madoff case, and now of course terrorism is still number one in terms of a threat.
Yeah, it is up there indeed. They're not used, to try to scare us or to whittle away our rights, or are they?
They don't. They're very, very careful about not abusing rights, despite a lot of criticism. They do make mistakes. They have screwed up. They have transposed telephone numbers, for example. They were supposed to wiretap, but it was all in error and not purposeful and not an abuse. On the other hand, in the paperback of The Secrets of the FBI that just came out, I have an epilogue that says that the FBI considers the New York City Police Department's surveillance of Muslims to be an abuse and a violation of their rights and also totally useless, developing no intelligence of any value, very similar to what went on under the Hoover administration in the FBI, they simply aimlessly gather information at mosques. They take down license numbers. They videotape people going in. And that's not the way to proceed in a professional way. It doesn't develop good intelligence. It betrays a lack of focus on the real issue, which is developing real informants who will give you real leads on real plots.
Are they concerned about anything in this country?
You would think that they would be very concerned about the constant criticism of the FBI and misinformation in the press about the FBI, because, just think of what it's like to go to work every day and see in the paper some misinformation. But they're really just too busy to worry about that. They work tremendous hours, and so I'm always surprised that they're not more bothered by that.
Is it still a good career for people?
It is, and it is tremendously remunerative after you leave the FBI. After 20 years in the FBI, you can retire and get a very high paying job in the security world,
And get your retirement.
So it's a very competitive deal. It's actually as competitive as getting into Harvard, and a very rigorous training course, of course, and it's a very regimented life. You know, it's a little like the military. So there are those drawbacks for some.
What did you find, Ronald, either in this book on the FBI or the President's Secret Service, to be one of the most compelling stories you uncovered?
Well, in the President's Secret Service, I tell the story of how George H.W. Bush was about to go give a speech in Enid, Oklahoma, when he was campaigning for re-election. And the Secret Service did their normal check with local law enforcement as part of their advance work. And local law enforcement said, you know, there's this psychic in town who's been incredibly reliable in the past and has actually led us to the bodies of murder victims. And she had this vision that Bush was going to be assassinated by a sniper at an overpass when he comes to Enid.
Uh-oh.
And so these agents took it seriously. They were embarrassed that they were taking it seriously, but they did. They went out and they interviewed the psychic, and they said, do you know anything more about it? And she said, yeah, I know that the motorcade car is already in town. And they said, well, where are they? And she said, they're at the Air Force base. And they said, can you show us where? And so they drove her out there, and sure enough, she pointed to the hangar where the limousines for the motorcade were going to be. One of five hangars. So, but then she said, when Bush comes out of Air Force One, he's going to be wearing a sport jacket and a sport coat. And they thought that's a sport shirt. And they thought that's ridiculous. He always wears a suit. But sure enough, the next morning, he came out wearing a sport jacket and a sport shirt.
Wow.
And a chill went down his spine, and they changed the motorcade route so it would not go under any overpass. And of course, he was safe. And he's reading about it for the first time in this book.
Did they ever catch what could have been an assassin?
You know, that's a great question. They never did go to the overpasses to see if anybody was there. That would have been very interesting.
But they should have.
Yeah, you're right.
If she'd been that accurate. What was the name of the psychic, Ronald? Do you know it, or can you give it out?
It is in the book. I forgot, though, and she's since died. But, you know, quite a story. Amazing.
Wonder if she's somebody who's been on our show before. You never know.
Yeah. And I think in the secrets of the FBI, the most amazing material is how they break into homes and offices. And that's just wild, wild stuff. And, you know, let's say they need to wiretap a mafia or bug a mafia home. They will introduce static on the guy's telephone line, and he'll call the telephone company, and sure enough, it's the FBI answering the phone, and they'll pretend to be the repair service, and they'll say, oh, we'll be right over, and they come over in their telephone company uniforms and their telephone company truck. They have as many as 50 FedEx and UPS and telephone company uniforms at their secret location in Virginia. And they will, of course, fix the line, but they will, meanwhile, install a bug in that telephone. And they also have a secret facility in Quantico, Virginia, where they manufacture, for example, lamps or vases which have bugs in them. And the FBI actually showed me a bug. I simply couldn't believe it. It was the size of a postage stamp, just a little bit thicker, and it could record for 20 hours, or you could tell it to transmit as you wish. That's how sophisticated bugging has become.
Would you rather be an FBI agent or a Secret Service agent?
Well, I think an FBI agent. It does span more disciplines. There are more kinds of investigations. Doing protection can be pretty boring, although the Secret Service also does investigate financial crimes, including counterfeiting.
Right.
You know, you have to understand that you might have to take a bullet for the president if you're a Secret Service agent. So they really are heroes.
Yeah, that's what they're supposed to do. Ronald, we're going to come back and take phone calls with you. Final hour ahead on Coast to Coast AM.